This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the social justice and human rights activist Julie Boltz, who spent the last 7 years helping to build schools in Afghanistan in an effort she calls Journey with an Afghan School. She's also pushing hard for the Global Fund for Education. Julie Boltz, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got involved in this work.
If you had met me about 10 years ago, I was a lawyer in a downtown Seattle law firm, and I specialized in international trade law and business immigration, and I had a successful international practice.
So why'd you leave it?
Well, ironically, and probably not to the surprise of many of your readers, I actually had a defining moment, actually a couple defining moments in my life. I used to define success as good grades, good salary, a good title, and it didn't take long to realize that by the time I should have felt successful, actually, I really didn't. And about the same time I was going through my little mini midlife crisis, one of my sisters got ovarian cancer, and I found that her touch with death really affected me. And
did she survive?
She did survive. But I found myself asking, do I like who I am? Do I like what I'm doing? Or do I like the legacy I left behind? And I ended up by taking what was then a 2-year sabbatical, and I moved to Africa to do something that really had been on my heart, which was social justice for women and kids.
Hmm. And where'd you go in Africa, and what kind of work were you doing there?
Well, my base was out of Zimbabwe, and I ended up by doing just a variety of things, from helping to change the constitution in Zimbabwe to limit Mugabe's term of office, changing the laws so women could inherit and own property, female genital mutilation, microfinance, a whole variety of things.
And did you go back to law practice then?
No, I didn't. And what I found, interestingly enough, is living in a mud hut with no running water, electricity, or in a township where people were in a tin sheds and cardboard boxes, they really taught me the definition of success was quite different than what I had been looking at. And it wasn't about title and salary and good jobs. It really was about relationships in giving back to other people. And so with that behind me, I resigned from my practice and really said, I am going to go serve the poor where I can to help empower them and make their lives better.
And did that take you directly to Afghanistan then?
It didn't. I've actually worked in about 70 countries around the world, and I ended up in Afghanistan not long after 9/11.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was back in the United States, but I think the thing that affected me most about 9/11 wasn't the actual event itself. I think having lived overseas, I saw the hatred that many people had towards America. So I wasn't surprised by what happened. But what I was surprised was more of almost the reaction in the United States from people who were shocked that the world didn't really love us. And so part of my work was not simply then about helping empower people, but was building bridges of understanding between our communities. And I really wanted to jump in there somehow to start alleviating those misunderstandings.
Now, you'd been in 70 countries, Julie Boltz, and you say you had an understanding, perhaps, or an inkling anyway, of why people hated the United States or didn't like us anyway. What was that about? Why didn't they?
Well, some of this actually has to go with let me jump back a second. This is very simplistic, but some of this has to do with the media, the radio, the television, the movies that we export overseas. The number one most watched television program in the developing world for many years was Baywatch. The number two most watched program, World Wrestling. So when you start looking at what is our image overseas, it was this false, pretentious image that really wasn't us at all. And then, you know, on the flip side is when you look at the United States, many of us had misunderstandings and misperceptions of what it was like in the developing world as well. About a year ago in Seattle, there was a cab driver who was killed, and he had a turban on. And when they interviewed this man, they said, well, why did you kill the man with the turban? He said, well, gee, I thought I was doing everyone a favor. He was one of those terrorists. Well, he wasn't a terrorist. He actually happened to be a Sikh who practiced Hindu. He was from India. Wrong country, wrong religion, wrong everything.
Did some of the hatred of Americans have to do with U.S. foreign policy and not so much cultural products?
Absolutely. And a lot of it also happens to do with our image through the corporations, the military, our politics. And I think that this is something that has been brewing for decades. It's not just something that occurred really overnight.
Because there is a sense of incomprehensibility here in the United States about what happened. Many people couldn't grapple with it. And I remember David Letterman saying, you know, or Dan Rather on David Letterman saying, you know, they want our VCRs or something, which I don't think really had that much to do with it. Yeah, go ahead.
I think one of the big things that I've seen is that one of the biggest reasons for resentment and anger overseas has to do with poverty. And if you take the globe and you divide it in half, literally one half of the world's population, or about 2.6 billion people, live on less than $2 a day. And when I go out into the country and I speak about poverty to kids even in kindergarten, and I say, what does $2 a day buy you? Does it buy you a new winter coat? Does it buy you a pair of shoes? Does it buy you a healthy meal? No, $2 a day buys you anger, frustration, and resentment. And the bottom line is, if folks like us don't start filling those needs, the extremists do.
Julie Boltz is my guest today on Progressive Radio. She's a social justice and human rights activist who's lived in 70 countries. She's active in an organization called Journey with an Afghan School, which she helped to found, and she's pushing this global fund for education around the world that Barack Obama talked about during the campaign that would give the 75 million kids in the world who don't have schooling a chance at an education. After 9/11, Afghanistan would not have been the first place that I would have wanted to go to. Why'd you choose to go there?
My hot button is pushed by social justice issues, and Afghanistan was the most poor and oppressed in the world. And I mentioned how half the world's population today lives on $2 a day. Well, in Afghanistan, they didn't even have $2. It was a dollar a day or less. And Afghanistan led the world in child mortality, maternal mortality, landmine victims, homelessness. One out of four people were homeless at the time I went in. And life expectancy was 43. Literacy rate in my region was 6.5%. So the United Nations actually has a list. Who's the poorest of the poorest of the poor? It was Afghanistan.
And did the oppression of women and girls have anything to do with you wanting to go there too?
Absolutely. Well, the other thing that happened to Afghanistan, it wasn't just the poorest of the poor, it was really the most oppressed of the oppressed. And from 1996 to 2001, that country was ruled by a group of extremists called the Taliban. And during their reign, they had a list of virtues and vices. Women couldn't work. Women couldn't go to school. Windows were blackened, so women couldn't look out. Men can't look in. Women had to wear a burqa if they left their home. And if they did have the opportunity to leave their home, they had to have a man who accompanied them. So it was really an awful situation for women and children and men.
How were you accepted there as a woman, as a white woman from the United States, for that matter?
When I first got into Afghanistan, I really didn't have any idea of what to expect. And having traveled all over the world, I have to say Afghanistan was almost like going back to the 13th century. So camels on the road looked like Marco Polo and the Silk Road. And for the years that the Taliban reigned, women were not outside. They certainly weren't uncovered. So here I am, a white Western woman coming into the country. I didn't wear a burqa, but I wore a chador over my head. And Ironically, I actually dyed my hair before I got there. I dyed it black. I have blonde hair. I dyed it black and I thought, oh, I'm going to fit in better into the culture. But the reality was, see, my hair could have been green because my face was showing, and it was so unusual to see women's faces that wherever I went, people followed me, and our car would be surrounded, especially by men wanting to look at me.
And how soon, you went there with the idea, what idea did you go with when you went to Afghanistan?
I first went into Afghanistan with a team that was focused on relief and development. So they had, a country had just gone through 30 years or three decades of war, and there was nothing. No buildings, no schools, no food, nothing. And really, we were there to do what we could initially to help the people, but also to get an understanding of what we could do in the future. And interesting for me is that after people got food and shelter and clothing, you know, the basics, when we interviewed the leaders in the communities and we said, what do you want? What do you need? Time after time, what they told us, schools, build us schools. And I think they understood that education is a building block to eliminating poverty, oppression, and extremism. And Afghanistan had literally fallen to the bottom because it had no education.
And so you started this group that was building, or you formed this group to build schools, correct?
Yes.
And tell me about that, and how many have you built, and how successful has it been?
When I first got back to the United States, the image that was etched on my heart is that for the first time in years, kids could go to school, especially girls. But there were no schools. They had all been completely destroyed by war. There were no schools, no teachers, no texts, no pens, nothing. And I went back to my community, actually in Seattle, and I started talking to my friends and families and people in the schools. And together, we decided that we would try to build what was then the first girls' school in north central Afghanistan. And we put together our pennies and we collected monies, and I sent it out to my team in Afghanistan. And little did I know that I really was causing a ripple effect. And this little movement actually started to explode. And one community after another came to me within the United States, and they said, how can we help? What can we do? And we went from one school to the next school, and we've now built 15 new schools, and we've repaired 15 others that were destroyed by war. We represent about 25,000 kids, and on this side of the world, in the United States, I have about 50,000 friends and families, nonprofits, all the way from National Geographic, Rotary, family foundations, small businesses, giving circles, supporting the project.
And if you want to support the project, you can go to affhope.org and find out more there. And it is a nonprofit. Now, it's not just building schools, though. You've got to dig wells and latrines and everything else. It's not just putting up a school, right?
Correct. And one of the things that we found is that simply building a school wasn't enough. I could take these kids out of a tent or out of a field where they had been studying. But the reality was that they couldn't progress a lot further unless they had desks and textbooks and wells for clean water or latrines. And so what I found is that I went from really building schools to school systems. And then the other thing that I found was that I simply didn't want to build a school and go away. Get to know me, don't shoot me. I wanted them to understand who we were, that I was not the Baywatch woman. And so part of my strategy has been quite different than some of my other colleagues out building schools. Each one of the schools that we've built is connected to a community in the United States. And the people in the United States have been journeying along with these schools to get to know the kids there and the families. And similarly in Afghanistan, they are getting to know us.
I mean, what do you mean journeying? Are they actually going over there, or they're communicating back and forth?
Both. We have schools that are sending things back and forth. We have poems, songs, photos, study guides. We're doing some curriculum facilitation. For instance, in Afghanistan, the kids are studying water. So in that country, we're teaching them about hygiene and the importance of water. And on this side, we might be teaching the kids what it's like actually to go to the well every day and carry water on their head. And we actually have had people go back and forth. So our hope really is to build these bridges of understanding between our communities so that not simply between Afghanistan and America, but also even within these countries. Afghanistan had a history of warfare where they're all fighting each other, and these schools have brought people together. And likewise here in the United States, I want people of all religions and economic backgrounds to also understand that we need to work together as a team.
Julie Boltz, the reaction in Afghanistan among the girls or the moms of the girls at the schools must have been heartwarming.
We are working in an area of Afghanistan that really supports girls' education. So not only have girls and women been thrilled by having these schools, but the reality is the men want them as well. And when we go into these communities, I don't simply go and say, hey, I'm building a school, take the school. They come to us and they say, hey, we're interested in having the school. We're willing and interested to partner with you. And it's only after we come together as a coalition that a school goes up. And that way, one of our successes is that none of our schools have ever been harmed or the kids haven't been harmed because there is buy-in and the community itself is really interested in education and sustaining the schools.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the security. I mean, you'd said a second ago, your goal is, you know, don't shoot me, get to know me, and the schools haven't been attacked yet. And yet I read about the Taliban regrouping. I know you're in North Central, and maybe the Taliban's stronger in the South there, but surely the security risk must be high in your mind and uppermost in your parents' mind. How do you deal with that?
Security is an issue in Afghanistan, and we live very different lives than the military who are out there. On the one hand, I would never exchange positions with folks in the military, but you don't hear stories about development workers very often. If I were to just do a quick comparison, my colleagues in the military or who work with USAID or who are out with the embassy live in a compound. And it happens to be surrounded by barbed wire, tanks, sandbags. They have curfews. They can't go out at certain hours. They go in vehicles that are armored. They have GPS systems. They wear bulletproof vests. They are surrounded by guards who carry guns. And we live in open communities. I live in a home that has no barbed wire. It has no guard standing in front with a gun. I walk down the street wearing my Afghan outfit, carrying a pencil and a textbook. And so we really rely heavily on getting to know the people within our community. And we hope that they actually understand who we are and protect us. And from what I have gathered from my 7.5 years out there, if something actually happened to me, I think several of the community members would actually step forward. Not several, the community in general would step forward to protect us.
So the community members are your guards, in effect.
They are.
I'm speaking with Julie Boltz. She's a social justice and human rights activist, children's rights activist, who spent the last 7 years working in Afghanistan and here in the U.S. to get Afghan kids schools, and she's been building schools, as many as 30 are repairing, building and repairing them. Why do you think the Taliban are regrouping?
Well, the Taliban never really went away. After the U.S. military went in and the Taliban was officially removed from power in December 2001, most of the men who were in the Taliban simply shaved and they went back into society again. And at that juncture, the U.S. military really pulled out of Afghanistan, creating a void. And this is the same thing that the U.S. did after the Soviets back in 1989. So the Taliban had plenty of time really to regroup. And from my own perspective, we never really hit the reason why the Taliban grew to begin with. I'm going to go back to this issue about poverty. because in countries like Afghanistan, if you are earning less than $2 a day and there are no schools and there's no economic opportunity, you tend to gravitate towards those people who start giving you the opportunity, albeit good guys or bad guys. And in this case, the Taliban once again had an opportunity to flourish.
Well, what's your view of Obama's military escalation?
I personally have been against the escalation. I find that, you know, it's a little bit of a catch-22. On the one hand, I believe that you need the military in Afghanistan, and I would not be able to work there without them. On the other hand, I find that the reconstruction really needs to be done by people who are experts. It's not individuals who are 23 years old, have never been away from home, don't know the language, don't understand foreign cultures. I mean, to me, the money should be distributed more fully between economics, agricultural products, microcredit projects, education, and those are the things that really help to transform society. And the bottom line is that the individuals who are working with these nonprofits like my own, they've been out there 15 years. They speak three or four different languages. They live in the local communities. They shop from the local bazaars. They are interested in being there. They're not being drafted there. They're volunteers in many cases. And so it's a very different group of people. So to me, they're the ambassadors. It's not the contractors or the Blackwater types of individuals out there. The type that you want being our ambassadors are really citizens just like you and me.
What do you think the likely effect of this escalation is going to be, or the attacks that have gone astray and killed civilians?
It has been extremely damaging within Afghanistan, because all of the good work that the military might be doing gets alleviated in almost a flash when folks are killed, especially by the drones. And that has been something which, when we're on the ground, we see this really firsthand.
Have people come up to you and say, you know, I just fled this village because it was attacked, or what do you mean firsthand?
Well, I think everyone has relatives or family members within Afghanistan who have been affected by this. And so what happens is the goodwill that has been generated is just completely shot.
Tell me about some broader work that you're doing, Julie Boltz. I know you're interested in this project called the Global Fund for Education. Why don't you explain what that is and why that's so important to you?
One of the reasons why I'm so excited about my work in Afghanistan is that the results that we saw with education weren't simply good, they were phenomenal. And there are these terrific statistics that you see how education affects every part of society, socially, politically, and economically. And what we saw in Afghanistan was just even tenfold, because we started at zero, and none of the kids could go to school. And I saw how mortality rates, birth rates, malnutrition declined, landmine victims went down, productivity went up. But I'm saying all of this because what if we could take what happens in the poorest of the poor area and apply it to other parts of the world? There are about 75 million kids around the world today who are not in primary school, mostly the poor, the vulnerable, and girls. And so my work has been to take Afghanistan as this little piece and to say, hey, if we can do this in places like Afghanistan, just think what we could do in places like Congo or Bolivia. And so I have been an activist with a grassroots volunteer organization called Results. And Results has 100 chapters across the United States. And our hope really is to bring attention to poverty in the developing world and what are some of the key things that we can do to alleviate poverty, and education is one of them.
Just give me a ballpark dollar figure as to how much it would cost to educate or get those 75 million kids into primary schools.
It would take about $11 to $16 billion. Now, what we're asking is that, let me just jump back a second. During his campaign, President Obama spoke about a global fund for education. And he, more than anyone else, having also been around the world multiple times, understands the importance of educating kids. It's really a building block to eliminating poverty, oppression, extremism, piracy. And so he introduced this concept of having this multilateral education fund that would help coordinate donors from around the world and monitor and make the tools more effective. And so part of my work then has been to hold President Obama accountable for this. Now, the United States' fair share is about a third. And so what we've been asking President Obama to do is not only to form the Global Fund for Education, to create it, but to fund it as well. And that's $2 billion.
And just to put that in perspective, the Iraq War has cost us $2 trillion. This bank bailout has cost us out of pocket about $600 billion, I think, and the Treasury is on the hook for about $2 trillion there with all the backing it's given in guarantees and insurance. So $5 billion in comparison to all that to educate 75 million kids, well, $5 billion sounds like a lot of money in comparison to the way we waste money in this country is a mere drop in the bucket.
Well, and my understanding is that every day the war on terrorism in Iraq alone is costing us $2 billion. So really what we're asking is one day's worth. Hmm. And paradoxically, given all the money that has gone into the financial bailout, really not one penny has gone to the poorest of the poor. Nothing has been designated towards the developing world. And there is a list that the United Nations has of those countries that contribute to development and aid in the developing world. The United States actually is dead last. Of this entire list of the developed countries, most people think we're at the top. We're last. We give 0.16% of our GDP every year.
The group you're working with is results.org. The group in Afghanistan is AFFHope.org. We have about a little less than 2 minutes left. Julie Boltz, social justice, human rights, children's rights activist. You go back and forth from Afghanistan to the United States. You've been in 70 countries around the world. It must be difficult to deal with the culture shock of coming back here or going back there. What strikes you about that?
I definitely live in two worlds. I think the biggest thing that affects me when I come back is that people in the United States really have no idea of how blessed we are. And as much as we are affected by a crisis right now, the bottom line is that very few individuals in this country are living in a mud home where there's no electricity or running water. Very few kids don't have an opportunity to go to school. People are not dying of dysentery on the street because of unclean water. And so to me, there really is a tremendous opportunity, despite this crisis, to reach out to other people, to come from the heart, and to help people. And I won't say it's...
Well, that's as good a note as any, probably, to end with, that we need to be aware of people all over the world and our responsibilities toward each other. Julie Boltz has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Julie Boltz founded this group called Journey with an Afghan School. You can find out more information about that at AFFHope.org. She's involved, as she mentioned, pushing this Global Fund for Education. You can find out more about that at results.org. Julie Boltz, thanks so much for being my guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.